Charity F. Edwards is an attorney and mediator in the area of professional licensing and ethics matters in Jefferson City, Missouri. She is former bar counsel for the Missouri Bar and speaks with Ed about civility in the profession. There has been a recent fervor about teaching lawyers civility when dealing with other counsel and adverse parties. Aren't these the principles we should have learned at our mother's and father's knees, but somehow seem not to have learned? Are more influenced by everything is fair in love and war, believing that the adversary system by definition is akin to war? Therefore, everything the lawyer does is fair as long as it is not prohibited by some code. With the fallout in the economy and corresponding pressure on the legal community, is this becoming more acute? Is the legal profession guilty of misconduct, or rather merely reflective of what is happening in the rest of our society? Meredy and Ed elaborate on this issue and what lawyers need to do in order to both effectively represent their clients and stay away from violating rules of professional conduct.
The first question would be, where do attorneys go for guidance to know what's civil, what's not, and how does this relate to being a professional, that is, to be a lawyer?
Well, that's a great question, Ed. There are a lot of guidelines out there that talk about civility in the profession. I think sometimes it's helpful to kind of step back and take a look at what exactly are we talking about here when we throw out this word civility, or as some people use the term professionalism. And the problem with that is it is sort of a hard thing to define, but generally we're talking about attorneys in their interactions with one another, engaging in courteous, cooperative behavior, and exhibiting fairness in their dealings with one another. And to a lesser degree, it also applies to opposing parties in the courts.
So in other words, you can be a mean son of a bitch as long as you're civil. Is that what you're saying?
Well, hopefully not. Hopefully the act of being acting in a civil manner is going to prevent a lot of that negative SOB kind of behavior that you're referring to. I think just taking a look at the rules of professional conduct that apply to any jurisdiction, you'll find a lot of guidance within the rules themselves, but also there are a lot of attempts that have been made out there to set forth guidelines for attorneys in their conduct in dealing with one another. The ABA has a nice set of guidelines for civil litigation that most people could take a look at if they were interested in exploring this a little further.
Well, how does this relate to being a zealous advocate? I mean, isn't that one of the rules, one of the things we've grown up with through law school?
Yeah.
And how does that relate then to the rules that we should have learned, if we didn't, at our mother's knees?
Yeah, Well, you know, that term zealous advocacy is actually a term that we're getting away from. It is one that I think I learned in law school when I was learning the rules of professional conduct. But in the revisions that we've had to the rules, we've kind of stepped away from that use of that term. And I think the reason is people tend to attach too strongly to that word, to the Z word, as I sometimes call it, and think that it means that you pull out all the stops and it's an ends justify the means kind of approach to things, because your job is to do everything you can for the best interests of your client. And in fact, that's not really what the rule is anymore, and I don't think it really ever was. The idea is that one should be take reasonable efforts in their representation of a client and be diligent and do the best that you can, but it has to be within the bounds of the law and the ethical canons.
Well, I think you've said two things that may not be complementary. And one is within the ethics, within the canons of conduct, if you will, and within the bounds of law. I mean, for example, if one were to submit an ex parte notice at 4:59 on Tuesday night, the day before the Christmas holiday,
mm-hmm.
knowing that the other side had planned to close their office.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that civil? It's certainly within the bounds of law, at least as I read the code. Is it civil?
See, you've got it right there. Yeah, it's within the legal parameters of what one can do. And that's the problem with simply relying on a set of rules, as so often even these guidelines for civil and professional behavior come about, they simply are a list of things not to do, usually. And the problem with that is anytime you have a list of things to do or not to do or a code of conduct, a set of rules, the argument is always going to be, well, it doesn't say I can't do that, so therefore it's okay, and they use it as a justification. But the problem with that is you have the type of situation that you exactly described there, someone taking an unfair advantage by forcing an issue like a last-minute motion when they know full well that it's virtually impossible for someone to respond to it and have a fair opportunity to do so.
What you're saying, in effect, and just being devil's advocate here, mm-hmm. that what's good for the goose may not be good for the gander. I mean, what you're saying is that you're going to sit on high, or the disciplinary board is going to sit on high and decide each case on its own merits and say, yeah, this was fair, that was okay, but this was not fair. And so how is the lawyer supposed to know? If a lawyer grew up in an abused household, to be blunt, the lawyer is going to be more likely to be a fighter than if somebody grew up in a calm, peaceful household and understands what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So where do we draw the line? I mean, they're both valid. They're both legal. And, in fact, aren't many clients looking for that tiger of a lawyer?
Well, yeah, you touch on a lot of things there. And I think one of the things that you're raising is where is the proper place for us to learn this kind of behavior? It's true that perhaps some people haven't had the advantage of learning good manners, so to speak, in their household growing up. And that's why I think it's really important to have dialogue about these types of things and mentors for attorneys as they're coming up in the ranks once they've gotten out of law school. I think that it's more a matter of dialogue and becoming role models for one another rather than simply relying on a set of rules. A set of rules, be it the rules of professional conduct or the Ten Commandments for that matter, or a set of guidelines for civil conduct between lawyers is only going to go so far if we don't talk about what it means and have real-life examples that we examine and have dialogue over to understand how it plays out. So I think that's a big part of it, that this whole discourse we have on civil behavior in the practice of law really needs to go far beyond coming up with a list of things that we all agree we're going to abide by or we're not going to do.
Well, I like your commentary about murky waters, because I think that most every war that we've ever studied in history, including the current involvement by the United States abroad has some religious connotation. You know, they started on the basis that this is right versus, you know, the other party being wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And if nations are performing actual war, you know, actions and activities, how is it that lawyers who are tasked with representation of conflicting interests, they're advocates, how is it that we're supposed to act any differently? Where is this? I mean, aren't you getting from the murky waters into touchy-feely utopian kind of wishing rather than guidelines or activities that lawyers can actually follow?
Well, that's a mouthful there, Ed. And I think that, yeah, you're right to a certain degree, that we are getting into, you know, looking at utopia, looking at what would be the best ideal situation that we could create. But isn't that what we should be striving for, really?
That's the real question. And I think that one of the ways that perhaps we can bring this discussion to some real meaning for our listeners is to give some real-life examples of activity that you might find normal but questionable. So let me start with one example which frustrated me throughout my entire 25 years of practicing before I became a coach and consultant for lawyers on the business side of the practice, and that is when I would be involved in a matter and have a sense of where it would come out if it were tried in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
And I would make a settlement proposal based on that opinion, which was obviously subject to negotiation and discussion, further discourse. But I wouldn't get any discourse from the other side.
Mm.
And ultimately, on the steps of the courthouse, just before going into trial, I would receive a settlement offer, which would be very close to what I had perceived to be the ultimate outcome. But in the interim, I had to prepare for the trial, which caused my client a great deal of expense. Now, is that within the context of your definition of civility and professionalism?
Gosh, that is such a typical example, too. I mean, how many of us encountered that specific kind of situation? Well, there's been quite a few attempts out there to come up with these guidelines for civility. The California State Bar has recently put forth quite an effort in doing this, and as I mentioned, the ABA, and there's a lot of other jurisdictions as well. And some of those would specifically address that type of thing. They throw out guidelines for attorneys and promote the idea that attorneys should adopt these various guidelines as their personal commitment to take an oath to uphold these things. And that's one of the specific things that is addressed. We will endeavor to confer early consistently about settlement opportunities, that attorneys will not take an unfair advantage in the timing of filing a motion, that sort of thing. So the things that you're picking up on and bringing up here are exactly the kinds of things that they are addressing, excuse me, in these guidelines for civil behavior between lawyers. So I do think that they can help us by giving us examples if we take a look at these sort of things and keep it in mind that, you know, although the letter of the law might allow you to get away with this sort of thing, it really does not do a service to the legal profession and the judicial process in the big picture.
Okay, but I'm a lawyer practicing on Main Street. Economic times are very tough. All I care about is getting more clients and getting the bills paid. Mm-hmm. Why should I care about the larger picture?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think it's much more important to people than they sometimes realize. You know, there has been for years a negative image of the legal profession, which actually pains me quite a bit because I think it's unfair in a lot of ways.
But can't you go all the way back to Shakespeare and before that to find the same image? I mean, we haven't done anything really to hurt that image, let alone help it, have we?
Yeah. Well, it's true. But perception is everything, as they say, and of course that perception is out there, whether it come from things like television shows like Boston Legal or some of the legal thriller movies that you see out there where they do whatever it takes to obtain justice regardless of the means and the legality of things. So there is this image of lawyers out there. There was actually a poll that was done, I think it was Columbia Law School, a few years back, and they asked people what their impressions were of lawyers and also other professionals. And one of the questions they asked was about the level of honesty among lawyers. The range of responses were from extremely dishonest to extremely honest, and then everything gradations in between. And it was something like 39% of the people responded saying that they thought lawyers were extremely dishonest, which I thought was rather shocking.
Mm.
And how this then applies to, you know, Main Street and getting the bills paid and getting your fees paid, I think has a real direct connection. If your clients have this perception of you, and of course your clients are members of the public who hold this type of opinion of the reputation of lawyers. If they perceive lawyers to be dishonest and they're observing lawyers engaging in uncivil conduct, often to their advantage because they of course want them to pull out all the stops for their own representation, they are going to be distrustful of a lawyer when it comes to their own personal interactions with them, perhaps when it comes time to pay the bill. They're more likely to be suspicious and distrusting of the lawyer when they take a look at their fee bill. So bringing it full circle, you're coming to the point where the lawyer can face a more difficult time getting their legal bills paid. And I can tell you from my work in the disciplinary field that a fee dispute is one of the most common things that prompts a complaint to the disciplinary authorities. Doesn't necessarily mean it results in a disciplinary action against the attorney, but it's something that prompts a complaint, and who wants to deal with that?
Of course, it certainly doesn't help when the press writes articles about lawyers and bill padding, and somebody's actually convicted of having padded their bill.
Right.
Clearly, that does not help us at all.
Absolutely.
But in our environment, there are two advocates, theoretically of equal quality, and a trier of fact. What role do judges have in the effort to become more civil, using your language, more professional, using your language, or just using the language of President Bush, compassionate in their approach?
Or the former President Bush, more kinder and gentler legal profession, perhaps.
There you go. Yeah, right. Somehow they got the language down. I don't know that they have the actions down. But it's a step in the right direction anyway.
Well, I think judges can speak up more when they see unprofessional conduct between lawyers. I think that they can take action and punish or verbally admonish the lawyers. I think they can be role models themselves. I think there are, I've experienced and I've heard stories of people experiencing judges making ad hominem attacks against lawyers within their decisions or from the bench. So they need to be the primary role models.
And how do they get taught? I mean, how do they get taught? They come out of the same law schools and the same environment we do.
Yeah.
So how all of a sudden do they, just because they put on a robe, switch their persona?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's going to come back to the dialoguing and the bringing forth these topics into discussion. There's a lot of continuing legal education seminars that go on out there, but for the most part, it's a lecture type of format. And so you can get your ethics credit for your CLE, but you really, you know, you're kind of going through the motions. If we can create forums for discussing these types of things, you probably have heard of the Inns of Court.
Yes.
And that would be a great place for these types of discussions, and in fact, that's one of the things that they try to promote is civility and ethical conduct within the profession. It surprises me, though, that the Inns of Court are not more well-known and more prominent in our legal community. Kansas City, here in Missouri, where I live at the present time, has a very good program. But many communities don't really have well-known and well-publicized meetings of the Inns of Court. So that would be something. Judges could initiate a chapter of the Inns of Court. We could, as a profession, not only judges but lawyers as well, try to engage with our law schools more so and try to get programs with more practical application available for the students. I think it's the state of Georgia, if I'm remembering right, that initiated a first-year law school course in professionalism. And some of the students that have come through that course have commented on what an eye-opening experience it was. I think there was one young woman who said something like, "I was so glad to take the course and find out that I didn't have to leave my personal scruples behind if I was going to succeed in the business of law." So that's kind of an eye-opening thing right there, that students are going into school thinking that it's expected of them to be, you know, cutthroat.
Well, the business of law is my trademark based in 1995 registration. And up until that point, most lawyers did not even think of the phrase, let alone think that what they did was a service business, let alone a profession. And I think you've just given me the topic of a discussion. I've been asked to make a presentation before our local Inn of Court and talking about the economics and, of course, the bottom line. And I think the real question, and I'll pose it to you here as we begin to conclude our discussion for today, I'll pose it here in this fashion. How can the things we've been talking about, civility, professionalism, whatever term we want to use to describe what I would otherwise call fair conduct, be tied to the bottom line, because that's what's going to move lawyers. If there's some connection between what they do and what they earn, they will pay attention. There's a phrase that goes something like, people act in accordance with that which they are rewarded for. So in compensation models within law firms, if you reward people based on the billable hour, that's what they're going to focus on. They're not going to focus on the governance of the law firm or anything else, just the billable hour. And so because the more billable hours they rack up, the higher will be their compensation. So how can we, to move forward, that which you're most concerned about and tie it to the bottom line for lawyers?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the comment that I made earlier about the distrust that is often generated by clients in reviewing lawyers' fee bills often comes from the history of watching the lawyer and knowing if they have the perception that this lawyer is willing to be dishonest or engage in suspicious behavior. So I think that's a big one right there. But the other thing is, as I said, oftentimes these situations can prompt a complaint to the disciplinary office. The complaint can come from the client in the circumstances I indicated, or it can come from a judge, it can come from opposing counsel, it can come from the opposing party. And if a lawyer is dragged into a disciplinary complaint, that takes time away from their ability to make a living. They can't get paid for that. In responding to a disciplinary complaint, this is not a cost that you can pass on to a client. So if you end up in a disciplinary complaint that you have to respond to, or it's something that is brought up before the court, and then there are responsive motions that need to be dealt with, sanctions that need to be paid, those, again, are not things that you can pass on to a client. So that's going to affect the lawyer's bottom line as well. I think another thing of particular interest to me in looking over some of my past research in this area, I ran across a statistic that 30% of clients who were interviewed, and these were related to large law firms more in particular, 30% of the clients said that they wouldn't necessarily recommend their law firm to someone else. And it all seemed to be, once again, tied back to this reputation of the profession. And if you have a situation where, as I said earlier, clients are observing that you are engaging in this kind of behavior, trying to get repeat business is again feeding your bottom line. But if they don't trust you, if they think that you are into sharp practices that perhaps they don't want to condone, it's going to affect your bottom line by getting return business as well.
Well, Meredith, I want to thank you for joining us today. You've highlighted some interesting philosophical issues, but also we can tie it to the bottom line, the economic well-being of our listeners, in two fashions. One is defensive. You want to stay away from the disciplinary board because that's going to take time. It's going to besmirch your reputation, which will affect your future business as well. And secondly, sort of offensive, in that you can use appropriate behavior to not only please the client, but cause them to make referrals of additional business for you, both of which are very, very important in today's world. So as we, at this time of year, think about 2009 and what that will mean for us, both from a professional perspective as well as an individual perspective, I think your words need to be taken to heart. So thank you again for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.